My guest at this time is Diana Furchgott-Roth. She's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She is a former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor. She is a contributing editor for RealClearMarkets.com. And she is also out with a six-point plan for how this president and this country can lower gas prices more in the near future rather than the long term, as the president seemed to suggest on Thursday. And Diana, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Real quickly, before we get to the 6 points, in a nutshell, if you can, what's the biggest reason for prices spiking right now?
Well, the biggest reason is the expectation that the administration doesn't care about domestic oil exploration, doesn't care about widening the sources of oil here in the United States. And we can see this again and again, not just with Keystone, but also with permits in the Gulf, leases that enable people to explore for oil offshore. All these are slowing down.
And so the first two out of the 6 points deal with that. Number one specifically is to approve the Keystone XL pipeline, which the president rejected as part of the payroll tax compromise at the end of the year, although the White House claims now that he did not kill it, but Republicans did by demanding a response so quickly. And your point number two is that there should be additional oil exploration, whether it's in the Gulf, off the outer continental shelf, and even on land. Talk about what impact just starting this exploration would have on oil prices.
Yes, but before I do that, I should contradict the misimpression that the president gives when he says that the Republicans did kill Keystone. Recall that last August, the State Department approved Keystone, gave it an environmental state of approval, and it was thought that approval of the pipeline would be forthcoming. And then in the fall, it turned out it wasn't. This is a great mistake, because Canada is one of our good friends. It's one of our trading partners. It wants to send us the oil to refine in our refineries in the Gulf. And these refineries are now using oil from Mexico and Venezuela. But these supplies are dwindling. So in order to keep all our workers employed in these Gulf refineries, in order to keep producing gasoline, which then, as well as being used here, also gets exported back to Canada and other places, we need to have more supplies of this heavy crude that Canada wants to send us. So not approving the Keystone pipeline is squarely in the administration's own court. And it is needless. It's a slap in the face of one of our greatest friends, Canada.
Now, if in fact we were to open up the Keystone pipeline and open up, you know, some of these other areas offshore and even on land, would the speculators then drive the price down pretty quickly? Would it take a while since it wouldn't obviously hit the market real quickly? How does that work economically?
Well, here's how it works, Greg. You know how when you hear about some disturbance in the Middle East, the price of oil goes up right away without even one fewer drop coming to the United States. In other words, supplies have not ended. Supplies haven't shrunk. But all of a sudden, news report about what's happening in Iran or Iraq or Saudi Arabia or a hurricane in the Gulf, price of oil goes up. It's because of expectations about the future. That's how prices are determined, expectations about the future. And if the administration made announcements about new leases, about states being able to drill for oil on their property, about approval of the Keystone pipeline, that would change expectations and prices would stabilize or fall, just in the same way as they rise, even when no oil has been taken out off the market. So prices would fall, I would argue, right away, even before the oil. The price is determined not by the oil that we have in our hands or in our storage, but about expectations of how much oil we are going to get in the future.
And let's talk about some of the other issues you have in your six-point plan, some of which folks may not be as well versed on. Number three is to add flexibility to boutique fuel requirements. There are different blends that are required throughout the year. There's a winter blend, summer blend, and different states have different standards for emissions and so forth. So how would you make that more flexible?
Well, there are 18 different kinds of gasoline, at least, sold in the United States. That means when there's a shortage of one type in one state, they cannot ship it to another, because these 18 types of fuel are not just the choice of consumers. They're what the Environmental Protection Agency imposes on different states. And if we were to, let's say, suspend these boutique fuel requirements just for, you know, a couple of months until the price of gasoline came down, that would very much help in reducing the price. Why? Because if there's a shortage of gasoline in one state, you can't just send it from the next state because it might be a different blend. So this would enable suppliers of gasoline just to send the gasoline where there is the most need, which right now they're not allowed to do because of federal law. I'm not suggesting at the moment completely ending these boutique fuel requirements. That's a decision for Congress, for legislators, for the Environmental Protection Agency. What I'm suggesting is, for the moment, just to suspend them for, say, 6 months.
Moving on to number four now, the president basically doubling down on his biodiesel idea. He was talking a lot about algae. The ethanol mandate that's been in place now for a while is still going in, even though its tax subsidy is over, as you point out. What can Congress do? What can the president do? And how quickly can they do it when it comes to dealing with ethanol?
Well, Congress could immediately change the law and not require the consumption of ethanol. Right now, the law requires 500 million gallons to be consumed in 2012, gradually increasing to 16 billion in 2022. And 10% of motor fuel used is ethanol, and it is more expensive than gasoline. Plus, with these volumetric requirements, as they're known, the requirement that we use a certain amount of ethanol, that is clashing with the amount of gasoline that we are using. Because believe it or not, despite what politicians tell us, we are using less gasoline, and we're going to continue to use less gasoline because we're using more fuel-efficient cars. Every time one of your listeners does away with his old car and buys a newer car, the mileage goes up. So we're, in fact, using less gasoline, not because we're driving less, but because cars are getting more efficient. So that's a long-winded way of saying that in order to use the amount of ethanol mandated by Congress in a law passed in the middle of the last decade, we need to be using more than 10% in our gasoline. But we can't use more than 10% in our gasoline because automobile manufacturers say that that's bad for the engine, the way cars are constructed right now. So what would make most sense would be to end the mandate to use ethanol. And then if ethanol was less expensive, people would use it voluntarily. If it was more expensive, they wouldn't use it. Gasoline blenders wouldn't put it in the motor fuel. So that is another suggestion that could go well towards lowering the price of gasoline.
And you may have a few folks out there scratching their heads as to why they're forced to use something to fuel their car that's not good for their car. But
Yes. And plus, it pollutes more. Ethanol is made from corn. If your listeners have probably noticed that corn used to be, at least in my area, 4 ears for a dollar. It's about double now. And now sometimes it's even 4 ears for $2. One reason for that is because farmers are producing more corn for ethanol, which is a different kind of corn. It's apparently increasing food prices all over the world. It does not reduce greenhouse gases. There's almost no benefits to ethanol, except it provides business for many of our farmers, which are a very strong lobby at the moment. And if that subsidy were taken away, they would perhaps grow other kinds of things. They might grow perhaps more corn for eating, and our prices are corn on the cob would go down, which I think would be a good thing.
Number five, this is sounds a little jargonish, but I know you understand it well. Explain how the importance of waiving low-carbon fuel specifications.
Well, there, again, these are different kinds of regulations which require states to use gasoline with low levels of carbon, and California has been instrumental in, again, requiring a different blend of gasoline, gasoline with less carbon in it, because that, they say, helps make the environment even cleaner than it is today. Well, I think it's fine to mandate these standards, but then that does mean that gasoline becomes more expensive, and people have to be aware of that. There's a trade-off. You don't get something for nothing. So, again, it might be a good idea to put these regulations on hold until the price of gasoline goes down, because $5 a gallon, $4 a gallon gasoline is not good for the economy. It's not good for Americans' budgets. You know, you're filling up your car and it costs you $60 or $75. That's money you can't spend on other things. And in terms of priorities, we need to think, do we want to make the air even cleaner than it is right now, or do we want to buy more groceries to feed our families, because these gasoline prices are having a real effect on Americans' budgets. Some people don't even fill up their cars all the way because they cannot be spending that $60 or $75 amount for a fill-up.
Point number six, and the president talked about this a little bit on Thursday too, saying it's time to end the subsidies for big oil. What the reality there is that they get tax breaks. They don't actually get money back from the government. But you say this is not a good idea right now. Explain why.
Capital is mobile. Companies go where the investment, where it's most attractive to invest. And so if you tax something, you get less of it. If we tax our oil companies, they'll take their rigs and go drill someplace else. What we want to do is keep them here. We want to keep them pumping up the oil here, giving it to us in terms of heating fuel oil, giving it to us in terms of gasoline. We want this to be an attractive place for oil companies to do business. We don't want to be raising taxes on them and having them go offshore to China or go to Europe or go down to Brazil. So that's why this is the wrong time to raise taxes on the oil industry. And the big companies, the large companies, don't get that much benefit from the taxes. But some of the benefits of the tax breaks that they get are shared by all manufacturing in the United States. And it seems unfair to penalize oil companies and treat them differently than other forms of manufacturing.
Diana, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Greg.
Diana Furchtgott-Roth, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor, contributing editor at RealClearMarkets.com. I'm Greg Karumbas of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.